You know that feeling, right? That invisible weight you sometimes carry. Maybe it's guilt, or that sort of cold grip of shame, or maybe just simmering anger, resentment, that feeling of being completely, well, stuck.
Yeah, stuck. It's like
Yeah.
it feels like we're all maybe recovering from something.
Exactly. Maybe even addicted in a way to the things causing the suffering. You know, greed, maybe hatred, ignorance, these deep things.
It's definitely a universal human thing, isn't it? And it can really, really hold you back.
It's way more than just a passing mood, too.
Oh, absolutely. When you cling to those states, they become these patterns ingrained, and you end up creating this kind of self-imposed suffering. It stops you moving forward.
Yeah, just dwelling on the past, holding on to that ill will.
It builds walls, doesn't it?
Totally. Walls around your own heart.
Which really shows how subtle these internal patterns can be. And today, that's what we're diving into, a practice that offers a really potent way to start dismantling those walls.
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness. But let's be clear, right? This isn't some quick fix, no magic wand here. Not at all. We're talking about something pretty profound, universal, really. It's got roots way back in ancient wisdom.
But with surprisingly powerful uses for, well, for right now, for
Yeah,
modern life.
exactly. So our mission today is to really unpack it, what forgiveness truly is.
And maybe just as important, what it isn't.
Yes, and how actually cultivating it can start to liberate your heart mind, lead you towards, a more peaceful life.
A more fulfilling existence. We'll be drawing on quite a mix of sources, right?
Yeah, a real tapestry, ancient Buddhist texts, some Stoic philosophy.
And bringing in contemporary psychology, even neuroscience.
Right. The aim is to offer you a pathway, really, a way to cultivate what you might call a perfect, unshakable freedom of heart.
A heart free from, what was it? Craving, aversion, confusion.
That's the goal, freedom from those core issues.
Okay, so let's start with some basics that often get confused. Guilt and shame. We kind of toss those words around.
Almost interchangeably sometimes.
Yeah, but there's a really crucial difference, isn't there? And it impacts how you move forward.
Huge difference. Guilt fundamentally is the thought, I did something wrong.
Okay, I did wrong.
Right, and that can actually be useful sometimes. It might prompt you to, say, make amends, or it can be negative if you just get stuck in the guilt.
Right, but shame.
Shame is different. Shame is the feeling there's something wrong with me for doing that thing. It's about your core self, not just the action.
Ah, okay. That feels much heavier.
It is. And our sources suggest shame is, well, it's rarely useful. It often just makes people withdraw, feel isolated.
So, if shame isn't helpful, what is in terms of acknowledging harm done?
What's beneficial is something called skillful remorse.
Skillful remorse.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's a healthy, beneficial expression of regret for actions that caused suffering, either to yourself or, to others.
So, it's acknowledging the impact.
Exactly. It acknowledges that principle of cause and effect, what some traditions call karma vipaka.
Right. Karma vipaka. Not like divine punishment, but.
Yeah. No, not punishment. It's more like a universal law. Every action, thought, word, it creates a fruit, a consequence, and that ripens eventually, shaping your experience.
So understanding that helps you choose actions that lead to, well, better outcomes.
Precisely, actions that cultivate positive results. Unskillful guilt, on the other hand, it tends to harden into this negative identity. I was bad, I am bad,
Or
or
even, I'll always be bad. That feels so final.
it does. And that's where letting go comes in.
Letting go of that hardened guilt, and especially the shame, right? And maybe perfectionism too.
Yeah.
That feeling of just never being quite enough.
Oh, definitely. That pervasive not enough feeling, not smart enough, funny enough, whatever it is, people are really looking to let go, Let go of past stuff, guilt, resentment,
And
regrets.
also future worries, anxieties.
Right. And this connects beautifully with Stoic thinking. Epictetus had this amazing line. He
Right.
said, "Don't hope that events will turn out the way you want. Welcome events in whichever way they happen. This is the path to peace."
Wow. Welcome events, however they happen. That's challenging.
It is. Think how much energy we waste fighting reality, wishing things were different.
So much energy.
Epictetus isn't saying just give up. It's more like radical acceptance. And that frees up enormous mental space.
So peace isn't about controlling what happens out there.
Exactly. It's about controlling your response to it. That's the real superpower, especially now when everything feels so overwhelming.
Okay, this idea
Yeah.
that our heart mind
Yeah.
actually creates our world. I mean, when I first encountered that, it kind of blew me away.
It sounds pretty out there at first, doesn't it?
Yeah, almost poetic. But how does that ancient idea actually square with, say, modern neuroscience. Christina Feldman put it beautifully. Whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon shapes the mind. The shape of the mind shapes your world.
And neuroscience is really backing this up now. William James, way back, said something like, thoughts become perception, perception becomes reality. Alter your thoughts, alter your reality.
Alter your thoughts, alter your reality. Whoa.
And David Eagleman, more recently, talks about how our life shapes our brain, and our brain shapes our life. It's a two-way street.
So our experiences aren't just, like, recorded?
No, they're actively constructed by our minds, your inner world, your thoughts, your focus. They literally mold your brain's structure.
And that structure then influences how you experience the outside world.
Wow, it's powerful stuff. Which brings us to something the Buddha talked about, two kinds of illness.
Mental and physical.
Right. He pointed out that, you know, you might find people who claim to be physically healthy for years, maybe even 100 years.
Okay.
But finding someone free from mental illness, even for a moment, that's incredibly hard. Unless.
Unless what?
Unless they've overcome what he called the intoxicating inclinations.
Intoxicating inclinations. What does that mean exactly?
It refers to these really deep-seated cravings. The big ones are craving for sensual pleasures.
Okay, that makes sense.
Craving for existence, like status or just continuing. And also craving for ignorance.
Ignorance, like not knowing
things. Yeah, not just not knowing, but almost actively not wanting to know. Wanting to stay asleep to reality.
Ah, okay. That sets things up perfectly, doesn't it? Mm. It shows why forgiveness isn't just a nice idea, but maybe essential.
Essential for liberating the heart from those deep patterns. Freeing us from that self-imposed mental illness of always clinging or pushing away.
Okay, so if our minds are that powerful and these intoxicating inclinations are so common, how do we even start? How do we clean up that mental landscape?
Well, this is where the ancient wisdom offers a really practical roadmap. It starts with some foundational principles, often called the five universal gifts.
Gifts, not rules or commandments.
Exactly. Think of them as gifts you give yourself and others. They aren't tied to one religion. They're ancient, timeless ideas for living a, well, a harmless and fearless life.
Reducing suffering for ourselves and others.
Yeah, basically universal common sense for how to thrive together.
And you mentioned they're ancient.
Incredibly ancient. We see similar principles popping up way before the Buddha. In Mesopotamia, you had the Ur-Nammu Code, like 4,000 years ago.
Wow.
And the Hammurabi Code a bit later. They were already tackling things like violence, theft, sexual issues, lying, intoxication.
So these ideas about basic ethical conduct, they're just universally human ways to create order and reduce suffering.
Seems that way. They promote social harmony.
And what really gets me is how these principles are framed. You mentioned a text, the Reward Sutta.
Yes. It explains that when you choose not to do these harmful actions, like not harming, not stealing, you're actually granting freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, and freedom from oppression to countless beings.
So by holding back from harm, you're giving a gift of safety.
Exactly. And the amazing part is, in return, you receive that same boundless freedom yourself.
It's like a reciprocal liberation.
Yeah.
A natural result of living skillfully.
It really is. Which brings us to a key point about forgiveness itself. It's not a one-shot deal, is it?
No, definitely not a quick fix for a wounded heart.
It's much more gradual, a process, an ongoing attitude you need to cultivate.
In your own time, at your own pace.
Right. It's like preparing the soil before you can plant the seeds. It makes space for that deep healing, layer by layer.
That really captures it, doesn't it? Cultivation. Starting small to build capacity. Reminds me of Shantideva, the 8th century Indian philosopher.
Shantideva, what did he say?
Something like, there is nothing whatsoever that is not made easier through acquaintance. Meaning getting used to things makes them easier. So through becoming acquainted with small harms, I should learn to patiently accept greater harms.
Beautiful. You build up that emotional muscle through practice, little by little.
Exactly.
And there's another powerful analogy from the Buddha for this kind of investigation. The surgeon's probe.
The surgeon's probe. Okay.
And in the simile, mindfulness paying attention is the probe. You use it to gently, carefully investigate the wound.
Okay, you're looking closely.
Then wisdom is the scalpel. You use that wisdom to cut out the foreign or contaminated material.
Like the greed, hatred, and delusion we mentioned.
Exactly. Cutting those out promotes real healing, real well-being. It's like precise inner surgery.
Okay, let's make this really concrete. Let's walk through these five gifts with some real-world examples. Gift number one.
Refraining from harming ourselves or others. Nonviolence, essentially.
And that covers thoughts and words, too, not just physical actions.
Absolutely. Thoughts, words, deeds. The reward Sutta mentions, refraining from taking life specifically, but it's about non-injury to any being, strong or weak.
Cultivating harmlessness is your default setting.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, gift number two.
Refraining from taking anything not freely given, theft, basically.
But it's broader than just, like, robbing a bank.
Much broader. Taking what is not given covers a lot.
Give us some examples.
Well, the obvious stuff, sure. But also subtler things, like collecting stationery from the office.
Okay, yeah. That pen that just sort of migrates into your bag.
Exactly. Or stealing time, slacking off at work, flaking on friends, not being emotionally present for loved ones.
Ooh, stealing emotional time. That's interesting.
Or withholding things, love, affection, maybe even money that's rightfully owed. And of course, we can be on the receiving end too, right? Being harmed when someone withholds love or through actual theft leaves deep wounds.
You mentioned a prison chaplain's experience.
Yes. This chaplain often asked inmates a simple question. Would you be here now if you had followed these basic precepts?
And the answer?
Consistently, 100% no. So many were in for theft, burglary, shoplifting, fraud, car theft, often driven by addiction or done while intoxicated.
A really stark cause and effect.
Very clear.
But it's not always about addiction or, you know, being a criminal. I remember the London riots back in 2011.
After the police shooting.
Yeah. And you had ordinary people just caught up in the moment, looting shops, taking really silly and mundane things, as one source put it, like chewing gum, bottles of water.
Just caught up in that 5 minutes of forgetfulness.
Exactly. But many got caught, ended up with criminal records, lost their jobs. The ripple effects from one seemingly small act can be huge.
It really shows how easily mindfulness can slip.
Okay, gift number three.
Refraining from sexual misconduct, illicit sex.
And the traditional texts talk about consequences like rivalry and hostility.
Yes, among humans.
Right.
And also potentially leading to rebirth in states described metaphorically as hell, the animal realm, or the ghost realm.
Right, and it's important how we interpret those realms, isn't it?
Absolutely crucial. Yes, some traditions take them literally, but they're also incredibly powerful metaphors for intense psychological states we can create right now.
So hell could be like unbearable inner torment.
Exactly. Or the animal realm might represent a life driven purely by unchecked instinct. The ghost realm, maybe that constant state of unsatisfied craving, always wanting, never fulfilled.
That makes those ancient concepts feel very relevant.
They really are. They describe states of mind.
And what drives this kind of misconduct, often it seems linked to deeper human needs, right? Craving for safety, security.
For sure. Sex is a basic human drive, deeply tied into our evolutionary psychology, protection, connection, procreation. But when that drive becomes unchecked or misused, it can cause immense harm.
We hear so many difficult stories.
Yeah, things like the link between, say, binge drinking and risky sex leading to HIV, or people mistaking sex for love, getting deeply hurt, prostitution, affairs. The impact is widespread.
You mentioned a story about someone named Ruth.
Yes, a very powerful account. Ruth shared her story of forgiving both herself and the man who abused her during childhood rape.
That takes incredible strength.
It does. And her key realization was about choice. She said something like, I cannot change what happened to me, but I can change my responses to it.
Wow. I can change my responses. That shifts the power entirely, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. It moves from victimhood to agency.
That's profound. For people listening who might carry burdens like that, what do you think is often the hardest part of making that shift, moving from victim to, well, survivor or even empowered?
That's a great question. I think often it's letting go of the idea that forgiveness means saying the action was okay.
Right. It doesn't mean condoning it.
Not at all. Or that it means you have to reconcile with the person who harmed you. Sometimes that's impossible or unsafe. The realization is that the power is internal.
It's for you.
It's for your liberation, your peace, not theirs. Understanding that distinction, really getting it, can be incredibly freeing.
That's a really important clarification. Okay, moving on. Gift number four.
Refraining from harmful speech. So false speech, harsh speech, gossip, slander.
And the consequence, according to the texts.
Basically that no one takes what you say seriously. Your words lose their weight, their credibility.
Imagine that. Not being believed, not being trusted.
It's a heavy consequence. The Buddha actually gave some guidelines for skillful speech. 5 things to consider before you open your mouth.
Okay, what are they?
First, is it factual? Is it true?
Right. Basic honesty.
Second, is it helpful? Beneficial? Will it lead to a good outcome?
Okay. Truth isn't always enough.
Exactly. Third, is it spoken with kindness, with goodwill, hoping for the best for everyone involved?
Kindness, okay.
Fourth, is it endearing? Meaning, is it spoken gently in a way the other person can actually hear it without shutting down?
Tone matters a lot.
Hugely. And finally, fifth, is it timely? Is now the right time to say this thing?
So even if it's true, helpful, kind, and gentle, sometimes you just hold back.
Sometimes silence is the most skillful response. If the person isn't ready or the situation isn't right, saying it might do more harm than good.
That requires a lot of awareness.
It does. And the list of unskillful speech is pretty long.
Let's hear it.
Lying, obviously. But also lying by omission, leaving crucial stuff out. Malicious talk, trying to break up friendships or ruin reputations.
Gossip falls in there.
Definitely gossip. Also, verbal abuse, profanity used aggressively, sarcasm, hypocrisy, belittling criticism, even just idle chatter that wastes time and energy.
Wow. It makes you think about how much harm words can do and how much peace we lose by engaging in that kind of talk.
It really does. Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic emperor, had some wisdom on this too.
Oh, yeah. The Stoics were big on controlling speech, weren't they?
Very much so. He said something like, most of what we say and do is not essential. If you can eliminate it, you'll have more time and more tranquility. Ask yourself at every moment, is this necessary?
Is this necessary? That's a powerful filter.
Isn't it? It encourages conscious engagement, not just automatic mouth running.
Okay, brings us to the fifth and final gift.
Refraining from intoxicants that lead to a loss of mindfulness, specifically things that cause heedlessness or negligence.
So, alcohol, drugs.
Traditionally, yes, alcohol was the main focus, leading to what's described as madness in humans and potentially those difficult rebirth states or psychological realms we talked about.
Hell, animal, ghost realms.
Right. But intoxication here can be understood more broadly, too.
How so?
It's linked to those intoxicating inclinations again. It can be a craving for sensual pleasure, sure, but also a craving for status, for existence, or even a craving not to be.
Craving not to be.
Yeah.
Like wanting to numb out.
Exactly. To numb pain, to forget, to just stay asleep and not face things. That ties right back into greed, hatred, and ignorance being the ultimate intoxicants for the mind.
And the real world impact is pretty stark, going back to the prison chaplain.
Yeah. That 100% no answer. Would you be here if you followed the precepts? Intoxication is so often linked to the crime itself or the behavior that led to it. Dangerous sex, violence, theft.
Leading to profound regret later on.
Almost inevitably. Which is where mindfulness comes in as the direct antidote.
Mindfulness, or sati in Pali.
Right. Sati literally means to remember. So mindfulness is about remembering to remember, staying alert, being careful, being present.
And by cultivating that presence, you can avoid slipping into those unskillful actions.
Exactly. You can choose clarity over delusion. Skillful action over harmful reaction.
So we've explored these five gifts as a foundation for reducing harm. How does this all tie back into cultivating that liberated heart we talked about at the beginning?
Well, the ultimate aim, the whole point of practices like forgiveness and following these precepts, is to arrive at that perfect, unshakable freedom of heart.
Free from greed, hatred, delusion.
Free from craving, aversion, confusion, that deep, stable peace.
And how is that state cultivated?
Through developing what are called the Brahma Viharas, or the divine abodes.
The divine abodes.
Okay. These are four boundless qualities of the heart you actively cultivate. There's loving kindness, or metta, compassion, karuna, sympathetic joy or gladness, mudita, and equanimity, upekkha.
Loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity.
Right. And forgiveness fits right in here. It's a liberating heart practice that both aligns with and helps extend these qualities. It becomes part of making an appropriate response to whatever life throws at you.
Tell me more about those last two, joy and equanimity. Loving kindness and compassion feel more familiar, maybe.
Good point. Mudita, sympathetic joy, is really interesting. It's the antidote to envy and jealousy. It's the ability to feel genuinely happy for other people's good fortune.
Even people you find difficult. Or people you need to forgive.
Ideally, yes, that's the practice. It counters that tendency to compare or resent. And upekkha, equanimity, isn't about being cold or indifferent.
No. What is it then?
It's a deep inner balance, a steadiness. It allows you to face life's ups and downs, the pleasant, the unpleasant, the praise, the blame, without getting completely swept away by them. You remain centered.
Okay, so forgiveness helps cultivate these states, and these states support forgiveness. It's all interconnected.
Beautifully interconnected. It makes forgiveness feel less like a chore and more like finding the wisest, kindest way to respond.
Like that Zen master's answer, Yanmen?
Exactly. What are the teachings of a whole lifetime? Answer. An appropriate response. Simple, but it covers everything. How do you respond to harm, to joy, to difficulty, to ease?
And it's not just Buddhism, right? This mm-hmm. idea of cultivating the heart.
Oh, it's universal. You see echoes everywhere. Jesus saying, love your enemies and make allowance for each other's faults. Forgive anyone who offends you.
Right.
Prophet Muhammad emphasizing the heart. In the body, there is a morsel of flesh, which, if it be sound, all the body is sound. This part is the heart.
Focusing on the inner state.
And St. Paul telling people to put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. And above all these, put on love. It's the same core message across traditions.
But it's not always smooth sailing, is it? We have these internal obstacles. You mentioned Mara earlier. Can you unpack that a bit more? It's not like a literal demon with horns.
No, not usually interpreted that way these days. Mara is more like the personification of all those unhelpful parts of our own minds.
Like the inner critic.
Exactly. The inner critic telling you you're not good enough. The voice that whispers, just do it later, procrastinate. The impulse to lash out in anger. That part of you that wants to keep you stuck in old, painful patterns. That's Mara.
Okay, so it's internal. Does Mara have a weakness?
Yes, a big one. Mara's Achilles heel is recognition. The moment you see those thoughts, those impulses for what they are, just unhelpful patterns, just Mara visiting, they start to lose their power.
Naming it helps diminish its hold.
Precisely. You stop identifying with it, you see it clearly, and it can't distort your perception as easily.
And these internal obstacles, they're often grouped together, right? The five hindrances.
That's right. The five hindrances are a classic map of these common obstacles. There's sensual craving, wanting pleasant experiences, aversion or ill will, wanting unpleasant experiences to go away.
Okay.
Then there's sloth and torpor, that heavy, dull, sluggish feeling, lack of energy or motivation.
Familiar.
Worry and remorse, that the restless, agitated mind often replaying the past or anxious about the future. And finally, doubt, specifically skeptical doubt, that undermines your confidence in the path or your ability to follow it.
So these are like negative habit patterns that cloud our minds.
Exactly. Like clouds covering the sun, they obscure your natural clarity and potential.
And it's important not to see them as personal failings.
Absolutely crucial. These aren't signs that you're fundamentally flawed. They are universal conditioned responses. They actually evolved because they were useful for survival way back when.
Like aversion to danger kept us alive.
Right. But now, in our complex world, these same patterns often get triggered inappropriately and hijack our brains, preventing clarity and peace. Wisdom, the Buddha taught, involves knowing these hindrances intimately, seeing them arise, understanding their nature, and not feeding them.
Okay, so we navigate the hindrances, we practice the precepts, we cultivate the Brahma Viharas.
Mm-hmm.
What's the payoff? What are the real benefits of doing all this work, especially the hard work of forgiveness?
The benefits are huge, really, and holistic. On a personal level, it helps you heal your own wounds, your own heart. It allows you to genuinely move forward with your life.
Letting go of the past.
Letting go of the anger, the malice, that constant churning. You regain peace of mind. You release that heavy feeling of being a victim. It's truly an act of radical self-care.
And it's not just mental or emotional, is it? There are physical benefits, too.
Surprisingly, yes. There's growing research showing that holding on to unforgiveness, that chronic resentment, can actually make people sick and keep them sick.
Really?
Well, right. Studies have linked the practice of forgiveness to things like improved survival rates in people with life-threatening conditions and fewer physical and emotional problems in cancer patients. Holding on to resentment seems to create a state of chronic stress, which impacts the body physiologically.
So letting go isn't just good for the soul, it's good for the body too.
It seems so. There's a really vivid analogy from Buddhaghosa, that 5th century scholar.
Oh yeah, about letting go.
About not letting go, actually. He said someone holding on to anger is like a man grabbing a glowing hot coal or your excrement.
Okay.
Intending to throw it at someone else. But who gets burned or fouled first?
The person holding it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It perfectly illustrates the self-harm inherent in holding on to resentment and anger. You are the primary victim of your own unforgiveness.
That's powerful. You burn yourself first.
And this ties into neuroplasticity again. Remember how thoughts shape the brain.
Cells that fire together wire together.
Exactly. But intentionally repeating mental states like choosing forgiveness, cultivating compassion, practicing letting go, you are literally reshaping your brain.
You're wiring it for peace.
You're wiring it for peace, for kindness, for resilience. As Daniel Siegel says, Where attention goes, neural firing flows and neural connection grows. You actively build the brain you want through the focus of your mind.
Yeah, so bringing this all together for someone listening, we've covered a lot of ground. Forgiveness isn't easy, but it's this transformative, lifelong practice.
A cultivation.
Yeah, a cultivation that frees you from suffering by changing those harmful mental habits. And it's supported by these universal gifts, the precepts.
And by actively growing those boundless heart qualities, the Brahmaviharas.
And the core message seems to be, it's about you.
Absolutely. As Jeff Oliver put it so clearly, forgiveness is not about others. It is about yourself. It's an internal shift.
Tara Brach described it as letting go of aversive blame.
Yes. A movement from blame to compassion. A fundamental shift, she says, from aversion to kindness, reaction to response, and from contraction to wholeness.
From contraction to wholeness. I like that.
It captures the opening up that happens.
So maybe a final thought to leave people with.
Well, there's that ancient truth, often quoted from the Dhammapada, hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end.
By non-hate alone does it end.
Simple, profound, and incredibly difficult sometimes.
So the question for you, listening, might be, what would your world actually look like if you committed to that wisdom? Not just as a nice idea, but as the underlying operating system for your heart and mind.
How might really embracing that truth that non-hate is the only way free you up? Free you to truly live what Mary Oliver called your one wild and precious life without being weighed down by regret?
Something to ponder.